You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire. Notes on last week's Twitter hack and on the allure of original gangster and other celebrity usernames. Using marketing databases for intelligence collection, the U.S. government mulls a ban on TikTok, Johannes Ulrich on Google Cloud Storage becoming a more popular phishing platform, our own Rick Howard on security operations centers, and a preview of the latest episode of his CSO Perspectives podcast, and more reaction to alleged Russian and Chinese attempts to hack COVID-19 biomedical research. From the CyberWire studios at Data Tribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Monday, July 20th, 2020. Last week's Twitter hack remains under investigation. Some personal data were taken during last week's Twitter hack, according to the Wall Street Journal. The hackers were able to change the passwords on 45 of the accounts they compromised, which of course opened the possibility that they may have been able to access users' information. Up to 8 of the 130 accounts affected are known to have suffered loss of personal information. No one has so far fully and explicitly connected the hackers of those behind the Twitter hack with natural persons. The New York Times followed the incident from chatter on Discord and concluded that the hack was the work of 3 people, probably young, at least 2 of whom shared an interest in collecting interesting Twitter accounts. 2 of them, one called Ever So Anxious and the other LOL, appear to have been involved in Bitcoin scams before. Both were also well-known regulars on OGUsers.com, a site frequented by those interested in acquiring short so-called original gangster usernames. OG names are regarded as having special cachet because they're normally associated with early adopters of a new platform. The other sort of username that's interesting to what the Wall Street Journal calls a subculture is, of course, the celebrity username. But neither Ever So Anxious nor LOL was the original hacker. The apparent originator of the hack, one Kirk, contacted LOL with the message, "You, bro, I work at Twitter. Don't show this to anyone. Seriously." What he shared was a demonstration of his ability to take control of coveted Twitter accounts. He enlisted LOL and Ever So Anxious as middlemen to sell hijacked accounts. Kirk is thought to have obtained access to a Twitter Slack channel where Mashable explains he found credentials posted. The hackers progressed to a celebrity Bitcoin scam. How he got that far is unclear. Twitter hasn't elaborated beyond saying Saturday, quote, "The attackers successfully manipulated a small number of employees and used their credentials to access Twitter's internal systems, including getting through our two-factor protections," end quote. So apologies are apparently due Plugwalk Joe, whom Krebs on Security identified as the moving intelligence behind last week's Twitter hack. His involvement was tangential. He was a customer. He acquired the Twitter account @6 from one of the hackers, Ever So Anxious. But that, the New York Times concluded, was the extent of his involvement. As we mentioned before, there's been no report of Kirk's being identified as a natural person. LOL said he eventually came to believe that Kirk wasn't in fact a Twitter employee on the circumstantial grounds that he seemed more eager to do the company harm than LOL thought a real employee would. Make of that what you will, since plenty of employees, a minority to be sure, but a non-trivial minority, do seem, as a matter of history, to have been willing to do their company harm. But in truth, very little is known about Kirk. He was an unknown on the various chat sites he engaged. He came out of nowhere, and then he vanished back into the virtual beyond. Researchers at Mississippi State University have shown the relative ease with which devices can be geospatially tracked through common commercially available databases, the Wall Street Journal reports. The study is interesting because of the devices it chose to track: Russian cell phones in and around Moscow and a missile test site in northern Russia, where there had been some indications that an accident had occurred. The results indicate, the journal says, the value such open commercial, marketing tools really, can have for intelligence collection. The U.S. government seems to be moving towards serious consideration of banning TikTok as a security risk. An op-ed in The Hill suggests that such a ban would be based more on the generally frosty bilateral relations between the U.S. and China than on specific cases of misconduct on the part of the social platform. But on the other hand, TikTok does collect a great deal of data on its users. The Washington Post collects expert opinions about Russian and Chinese hacking of COVID-19 vaccine research and finds they differ over how to respond and even whether the hacking represented legitimate intelligence collection or a clear violation of international norms. Norms or no norms, there is a significant amount of bipartisan animus directed toward recent incidents of biomedical research hacking. The BBC reports that the Russian ambassador to London says Russia didn't do it. So there you have it. Joining me once again is Rick Howard. He is the CyberWire's chief security officer and chief analyst. Rick, you are kicking off a new season of your CSO Perspectives show that is over on CyberWire Pro. And you're starting off this season with an exploration of SOCs.
Yeah, Security Operations Center. I built many of them, toured millions of them. And, and you know, I thought that I knew the history of SOC evolution. And as I was digging into this, I discovered that I was completely wrong. I mean, it turns out that operations centers, the idea of them, that you might need them, they've been around since like 5,000 BC. Can you believe that? 5,000 BC.
Really?
Yeah. And we started to see the basic edges of the modern day security operations center, you know, in the early 1900s as the telecommunications industry started managing these giant networks of telephones. And then we saw the first real operations center to do it in the early 60s. So that's pretty exciting. But through the next 30, 40 years, we get this evolutionary change from not only the telecoms, but from the intelligence community, from the government, from the commercial sector, and all these folks, all these groups have started taking hits at how do you build these things.
I always think of the communication center in the movie War Games.
True. That's what all, that's every SOC I've ever been in, we were trying to build that operation center
right.
to some extent, okay?
Right.
Even
right.
if it's two guys and a dog next to the coffee pot, okay?
right.
You know, but I was, as I was looking into this, though, we've discovered that the evolution of SOCs have really stagnated, like, since the early 2000s. They haven't really changed that much. And I was talking to Helen Patton. She's the Ohio State University CISO about this kind of lack of momentum and also about how she is managing the zero trust policies from the SOC. And she had this to say.
The other challenge about research, which people sort of forget about in the private sector, is depending on where you are in the research cycle, your confidentiality requirements change. So, for example, yeah. in the beginning, when you've just got an idea, you want everyone to know about your idea because you want to crowdsource ideas and you want to get best thinking and you want to attract people to your cause. And so it's all public and it's great, right up into the point where you've got a patent and then you don't want anyone to know. And, mm-hmm. you know, and now it's locked down tighter than a drum. And then once you publish, now you want it to be all open again because you need people to come in and validate that your research is good and all this kind of stuff, right? And we haven't built zero trust protocols or access and authorization protocols around a changing life cycle requirement.
So she's basically saying that our concept of zero trust is not really mature enough to handle dynamic access rights. And this is something I've never even considered. You know, when I think about zero trust, I'm thinking, you know, we want to limit the marketing department from getting to the financial database. And, you know, that's good enough.
Right.
But what Helen is talking about is she's got a group of individuals, researchers at her university doing COVID-19 research that has varying degrees of requirements for access rights, depending on where they are in the process. And the zero trust platforms that we all use today just aren't strong enough or mature enough to handle that.
I mean, is it fair to say that there's been sort of this push and pull, this tension between what's needed and what's possible throughout the history of SOCs themselves?
Absolutely, right? And, you know, we've always wanted more in the SOCs. And by the way, I've never gotten it, okay? I think in my mind, what I would really want in my own security operations center is security operations, network operations, physical security, all in one spot with the authority to make decisions to counteract some bad thing that's happening. Nobody that I know of has a SOC like that, and I really do think it's the way it should be.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's much more where that came from. Do check out Rick Howard's CSO Perspectives podcast. That is part of CyberWire Pro. You can check it out over on our website, thecyberwire.com.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero trust AI.
And I'm pleased to be joined once again by Johannes Ulrich. He is the Dean of Research at the SANS Technology Institute and also the host of the ISC Stormcast podcast. Johannes, it's always great to have you back. You have been tracking some stuff that's been going on within Google Cloud and some folks using it for phishing. What's going on here?
Yeah, that's something that we have seen sort of pick up beginning of the year. And by now, pretty much all phishing attempts that I am receiving that sort of matter, that make it past my spam filter and such, they use Google Cloud Storage to actually store the phishing page. Now, we have seen this in the past with some of the Microsoft Cloud and such, but I guess they have gotten better in preventing this and cleaning this up. Turns out with Google's storage API, those pages are quite persistent. And it's a little bit limited what you can do. You can basically just have a static page there. But then they just add some JavaScript that will forward the data that the user submits to whatever actual sort of data collection website the attacker has set up.
So why Google? What's causing them to choose this?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. Now, first of all, Google is ultimately sort of a trusted site. The URL, the host name they're using is storage.googleapis.com. Like with all these cloud providers, there's a lot of necessary good stuff on this host name, so you can't really blacklist it. On the other hand, I found that Google is quite slow in removing these phishing sites. And that may also sort of contribute a little bit to Google becoming more popular and some of the other providers becoming less popular because, well, now the attacker has more time here to collect data. Because the page they have to sort of protect is the page the user gets to first. And that turns out to be here this storage.googleapis.com. If their collection site gets taken down, they can just make a change to the JavaScript in the collection page. But users that received the email in the past that actually triggers them to go to the phishing site, they'll still end up on that phishing page. So this is sort of the part that attackers usually have to keep up the longest. And if they can keep that up for a week, that's usually all they need to collect all the credentials that they would get out of a particular phishing run.
And does that initial page, at first glance, does it seem benign? Is it the sort of thing where you could understand how a surface inspection by Google, for example, would not raise suspicions?
Well, actually, it usually is just copy-pasted code from the particular page that they're trying to impersonate. So some simple signature-based matching or so may actually capture a lot of these pages. And once the user is done with the page, they usually will redirect them like to the user's domain, kind of trying to fool the user into believing that they just entered the wrong credentials. And of course, they may then try again.
I see. So what are your recommendations here for folks to protect themselves?
This is something where you probably have to rely on user education. I would still recommend report these pages to Google as much as possible. Like Google Chrome has sort of a little add-on that makes it really easy to report phishing sites. I hope that Google will eventually get better in cleaning up these pages as people report them.
All right. Well, Johannes Ulrich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Today's episode is sponsored by SRM, your first call for cybersecurity and investigations. Threats today are evolving faster than ever before, and since 2005, SRM has pioneered tailored security solutions for global corporations and their executives. Whether it's defending against cyber attacks with their award-winning team of ethical hackers and incident response specialists, or navigating the murky waters of compliance and ESG challenges, SRM's insight and straightforward advice will help you navigate complex risks and emerge more resilient. Their secret? A culture that nurtures the sharpest minds, giving them access to the newest technologies and the freedom to solve problems in new ways, enabling them to craft simple, effective solutions for your unique cyber challenges. Search Your First Call to discover how SRM can help your business.